Hello and welcome to the Licensed and Queer podcast, where we're on a mission to uncover why James Bond appeals so much to LGBTQ plus people. Why not see 007 from a different angle?
I'm delighted to be joined today by Stephen Bourne, an author whose work I've admired for quite some time, actually. I came to Stephen's work through a book called Fighting Proud, which many licensed queer followers will have seen me posting about on social media a couple of times, actually, particularly around important events like Armistice Day and that sort of thing. So Fighting Proud explores the untold story of the gay men who served in two world wars. And regular followers will know how much I love untold stories, hidden histories and that kind of thing. So I basically ate my way through that book in about 2 days. And it's a book that I've gone back to quite a bit since then as well, as a reference book. And then I also picked up a book called Brief Encounters, which was Stephen's book on lesbians and gays in British cinema 1930 to 1971, in which several Bond films feature. But Stephen, there's more to you than just those two books. You've been writing books since 1991, is that correct?
Yes, thank you. My first book was published in 1991, but I'm not from an academic background. I left school with nothing. I pretty much self-taught, and although I did do a degree and a master's later on in life, I didn't really connect with the world of academia. So my very first book was very much based on interviews with an elderly aunt who was a black British, a black Londoner born in 1912. And we had a very close relationship. She'd been adopted into my family during the Second World War. But the point being that it was her telling her story and with me kind of editing it and giving it a framework. But it was published as a local history book because back then we had funding, what I call the F word, funding for local history publishing ventures. Right. And that was true of the lesbian and gay community as well. If I say lesbian and gay, it's just that I'm being old-fashioned. I'm using terminology that was relevant to that time period. We were not LGBT then, or LGBT plus. We were lesbian and gay, and that's why the book Brief Encounters, which was actually my second book. There was a five-year gap, and then Brief Encounters was commissioned. But Brief Encounters was commissioned because Cassell, C-A-S-S-E-L-L, the brilliant publishing house, which no longer exists, they've been assimilated into another publisher. and they created, or a couple of a lesbian and a gay editors, a lesbian editor and a gay editor got together and created a lesbian and gay list in 1993, I think it was. So all of us that wanted to write lesbian and gay history books and cultural books and music books or whatever kind of rushed at them. And mine was eventually commissioned, Brief Encounters, because by then I had become very interested in how we as a community had been portrayed in British popular cinema.
So what drives you to write all these books on these topics? Because I think we've probably got some common ground here. Having heard you on another podcast as well, I know that you're really interested in things that perhaps have got left out of history. Quite a lot, groups of people, individuals as well. So is that kind of one of your big motivators to research and write about these topics?
Absolutely. I mean, the bulk of my work has been really Black British history. The best known book in that field is probably Black Poppies, which is a book I wrote to coincide with the centenary of World War One, about the Black servicemen in the First World War and the wider Black community in the First World War. That's gone into three editions. I mean, that's how popular that book has been. And it's very much coming from a working class background. I wish there were more opportunities to work about to write about being working class, but it's just not done. There's so many middle class people in the publishing world, they don't connect with working class. So that is a kind of area that I'd like to go into more and more. Mm. But that it isn't really easy to do that. But the Black history books have done really well and reached their readers. The gay history books, it took Brief Encounters was published in 1996, mm. Fighting Proud in 2017. How many years is that? 17, 18, 20, 21 years? So there was a 21-year break between the two gay books. That wasn't anything to do with me. It was just publishers were very resistant. I realised that in that period, particularly in the year after Brief Encounters, if you went into bookshops or libraries and went to the queer section or the lesbian and gay section, it's predominantly fiction or tourist guides. And I was thinking, like, and I was trying to get gay history books published. No, very resistant. Fighting Proud was, I wasn't going to write it. The editor came to me, the editor at IB Taurus.
Wow.
Yeah, contacted me and said, would you be interested? Because I'd written an article for a magazine about the subject of gay men in the Second World War. And he loved it. And it was in the BBC History magazine. And this editor loved it and came to me and made a personal approach. And that's very rare. So that's how Fighting Proud happened.
I think it's such a fascinating book because, you know, there's this image of warfare and it being this highly masculine pursuit. And then you bring queerness into it. And it's sort of what I'm trying to do with James Bond.
Yeah.
He's seen as this very heterosexist kind of worldview. But then there are a lot, and I realize now, you know, 3.5 years after starting what I do, that I'm hardly alone in being a queer Bond fan. They're just not terribly visible, and they've often been left out of the discourse around James Bond. So in a sense, I'm trying to open people's eyes to that.
Yeah, and opening people's eyes.
Yeah.
And providing people with other narratives.
Mm.
It was never political. I never set out to write gay history books and Black history books for a political cause, you know, to be right on. It was never that. It was never planned. It was just something that evolved over time. And because I had this, what I now realise as I'm older and look back over all these years, is that in the early days, being educationally disadvantaged was a disadvantage and did impact on me greatly, but I still pursued what I wanted to pursue. And it's only now that I look back and I realize it was fortunate in a way that I didn't have an education at the beginning, that I didn't go to university and get bogged down with all that words ending in ology and having to follow that approach. It's difficult to put into words, but it just freed me to be much more open-minded. So to go back to your original question about what drives you, it's just, I'm just fascinated by what I keep uncovering, whether it be gay men's history or Black people's history in Britain. It's fantastic.
Do you think it's almost, you're kind of very multidisciplinary? I know you define yourself as a historian, but your books encompass so many other elements as well. And I try to do that in what I try to write, because although my background educationally is in English language, you know, it's linguistics and literature and then leadership theory, you know, for the day job in my master's and all that sort of thing. I always want to find out about psychology. I want to find out about sociology. I want to find out about history, even though I've never studied it. So in a sense, whenever I start writing about a Bond film or a book or something like that, I go in just completely open and go, right, let's see what we're going to find.
Yeah.
So there might be some people who read my stuff. No one's ever said this, but maybe they're just being polite. But people who go, will you just choose a discipline? And I'm just like, no, I'm going to write in 7 different disciplines in this article. Yeah. And, you know, because that's how my brain works. And this
I've found over time, and as I say, it's evolved. I have to keep an open mind. And what I say to people is, and I apply this to both gay queer history work I do and Black British history, is that, so when I give a Black History Month talk or black history talk, I always say to people, not all white people were racists. Not all black people saw themselves as victims. And it applies to gay men, for example, or LGBT. Not all straight people were homophobic. No. Not all gay men saw themselves as victims. What I learned from Fighting Proud, as I learned from Black Poppies before it, are the positive stories, the positive narratives that historians immersed in this kind of work tend to overlook, either choose to overlook or don't consider it important or don't even think about it. And what I've discovered for myself is that, David, that not all black people were victims, not all white people were racists. And you can apply that to gays and LGBT people in Britain as well. There are some terrible stories.
Yeah.
And we know a lot about that because that, a lot of that's been written, but it's always been the driving narrative. Homophobia, racism have always been the driving narratives. And I don't see that there's anything wrong with that because that's predominantly what gay men and black people were experiencing, whether it be the Victorian era or the First World War, whatever. But what I've discovered is the exceptions to the rule. And it's the exceptions to the rule, the gay men that as I've written in Fighting Proud, who were accepted and embraced and were part and were comrades, and the black men in the First World War in Black Poppies, who were comrades in arms with their white soldiers in their battalions. Fantastic to have been able to reach a point in my career that I can openly talk about this now, because I've been doing it for so long. The evidence is there in my books. I've written about it. They're in the public domain. And I don't get criticized. I get hugged. I got hugged at a Black History Month event for saying this a few weeks ago at the end of October. I got the people just come up, black people in the audience just come up and hugged me. It was just so moving because I'm offering something different. I'm not trying to be a denier. Far from it. I'm just trying to add other narratives.
I think it's because people resist the complexity sometimes. So I've written a lot about how queer people were treated really badly, and you know, jumping off, you know, something like From Russia with Love, which is kind of indirectly related to the KGB trapping British agents, gay British agents, and you know, and the before homosexuality was partially decriminalized. Funny enough, today, the day we're actually recording this, is the 20th anniversary of Section 28 being repealed, which was horrendous, and the impact of it on schools. So I've written about, you know, yes, queer people were treated incredibly badly in the past, but as you said, not by everyone. And one of the for some people apparent contradictions with James Bond is that Ian Fleming's basically most of his close mates were gay or bisexual men, you know, and yet there is nothing really that there are a few bits that are explicitly homophobic in the James Bond books, yeah. But actually it's nearly always a bit more ambiguous than that, and James Bond pities gay people, which is still not great. And I know, like, fans, like gay fans, and in fact both of them are mentioned in Fighting Proud, actually, like W.H. Auden and Christopher Isherwood were both big fans of Fleming, even if they didn't like the way gay people were treated. So it's never been as simple as, you know, Fleming and the Bond films have been homophobic. It's like, well, they were partly reflecting the society and some people's views, but in other ways they really weren't. So they actually featured these characters. So they were daring enough to do it.
I mean, I suppose there is one argument that I've always heard, is that better some representation, even if it's negative, than no representation at all. But it's interesting thinking about this, because when you asked me to do this interview or this conversation, I went back and reread what I'd written about Rosa Klebb, and I got his name wrong, didn't I?
Error. I wasn't going to bring it up, Stephen, but yeah, you do refer to Mr. Wind as Mr. Wind. But it's
I don't know why I did that. It must have been the source I was using. It says Mr. Wint And what was the other man's name?
Mr. Kidd. You know what's really strange, though? Even though that film is ingrained, Diamonds Are Forever is ingrained into my like DNA. In fact, I'm using my Diamonds Are Forever mug today. I love that film, and I'm a sort of apologist for that film, partly because of its queer portrayal, which is not always radiantly positive. But even though I love that film so much, I still sometimes get the characters mixed round. So I'm like, which one's Kid and which one's Wint? And yeah, for some reason, I always do it. So you getting it down as Mr. Wind is completely excused.
But what I'm trying to say is that in 1996, when I revisited From Russia With Love and Diamonds Are Forever, I was still stuck in that kind of way of thinking that this is homophobic. Yeah. You know, I'd read Vito Russo's groundbreaking, trailblazing book, The Celluloid Closet.
So good. And the documentary's great as well.
But over time, when I look at The Celluloid Closet now, the book, I kind of think it's of its time. And it was...
Definitely.
He wrote it brilliantly, and we all love the book. But now I kind of think, why did he bother watching all these films? He obviously hates them all. It's like, is it one film he liked? It's like, so what? Let me try and finish this, because I want to try and get to a point where I can explain what I'm feeling. So I reread. I was sort of in that mode in the 90s, still being very hypercritical of anything that smacked of homophobia or gay and lesbian stereotypes. So I'm looking at Rosa Klebb when I was writing Brief Encounters in the 90s and thinking, oh, you know, you can't portray lesbians like that. It's terrible. It's wicked. It's cruel. It's insulting. And then I looked at Wint and Kid in Diamonds Are Forever, and I thought, oh, no, these homophobic, nasty characters, nasty, nasty. And when I reread what I'd written, which wasn't that much, I just burst out laughing, because if I watch those films now that we've had a plethora of positive images, for want of a better term, more honest images of gay men in films, I just laugh at them. I just think, actually, I like those characters. They're my guilty pleasures. And the reason being, they're disrupting the heterosexual narrative.
Absolutely.
And now it's beginning to sound like Professor Stephen Bourne from some university up north. I'm not. It's just how we change as we grow older by keeping our minds open. You have to keep an open mind. And I'm not suggesting for one minute that Wint and Kid and Rosa Klebb from those films are positive role models and young LGBT people should look to these films. No. They're still nasty characters.
Yeah.
But I love the way they are there to, I mean, some would say to reinforce James Bond's heterosexuality and his macho-ness. Okay. But they're also there to disrupt the narrative and offer something else. and I just love that aspect. I think a lot of Black audiences now, particularly in America, African-American audiences, are beginning to recognise that those older stereotypes are still offensive in Hollywood movies, Black stereotypes, Gone with the Wind and all those kinds of films. But you can still see something different, you know, that there's something multi-layered in there if you look for it. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense, and it's always been my argument as well. There was a brief period in my life, and I've written and spoke about this a fair bit, and I've recently been kind of writing even more about it. There's a brief period in my life where I actually fell out of love with James Bond, because I thought some of these portrayals were so negative.
Yeah.
It was even before I came out, but I realized obviously who I was. Now I've been out for some time. And I realized that when I was watching these films as a kid and a teenager, I probably identified quite a lot with those characters, not the whole murdering people side of things, but as you say, as kind of people who didn't fit in with society. So in a sense, they were positive representation. And at least I always say, at least Wint and Kid love each other. Yes, they're serial killers, but they are in a, you know, they've got some kind of redeeming quality to them.
If you don't mind me kind of broadening.
Yeah.
out to the gay icon Shirley Bassey.
Yeah.
And Shirley Bassey never had a film career, but she did have the Bonds.
Yeah.
She did three. And, you know, the opening sequence of Goldfinger with Shirley Bassey belting out that brilliant song magnificently. You know, it gave her a place in the Bond films, but we never actually saw her. We saw an imitation of her in Live and Let Die with Brenda Arno singing the title song. Tacky, Boreham Wood, Shepperton vision of a New Orleans nightclub. It's like, please. But at least in terms of cinema, Shirley had an opportunity to contribute, even if she was denied the role of Nancy in the film musical Oliver. She was up for it and she wanted to play it. And Carol Reed, the director, wanted her.
Oh, right.
But the timing wasn't right. The American backers wouldn't allow a black woman to portray such a major role in a Hollywood Hollywood British musical. So I love that kind of aspect of the films. But going back to Goldfinger, that was, you see, the Bond films have always been part of my life, because if you're born when I was born at the end of the 50s. The 1960s were a phenomenal period for me as a very young child. You know, Vietnam War. No, let me tell you how I explain it. So at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm watching Valerie Singleton making something out of sticky back plastic. And then an hour later, some child being napalmed in Vietnam on the news. It was that extreme, what we were as children of the 60s. I mean, I was a very young child at primary school, exposed to. And it was the Beatles, and it was Vietnam War. It was the assassination of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy and Valerie Singleton and John Noakes. And it was this kind of mixture of things. And the Bonds fitted into that, because the very first Bond film I ever saw, I was only six. And we went as a family. I remember we went as a family because I don't think my mother and father could get a babysitter. So they said, let's bring Linda and Steve and me and my sister along. And we were very young. And I remember seeing it and enjoying it in a way. I don't think I understood it. But we loved Odd Job. We thought Odd Job was brilliant. This was Goldfinger at the Peckham Odeon, 1964. And we thought Odd Job was just so funny. Again, he's like almost like a comical character, but he's a villain.
Yeah.
And a racial stereotype, some would argue.
Probably. Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, I don't think, if it's any consolation, Stephen, I don't think any grown adults really understand the plots of most Bond movies.
Exactly.
The plot is sort of immaterial, to be perfectly honest. And that's not denigrating the writers, because they do a good job of just about not making you think about the story enough, I think, most of the time, to kind of just take in the other pleasures. But yeah,
But someone from my generation, obviously my Bond, it's like my Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Is Hartnell.
Yeah.
I'm that old. And Patrick Troughton. My Bond is Sean Connery. I never took to Roger Moore. There's still a couple of Roger Moore films, Bond films, I've never seen. I've never seen The Man with the Golden Gun. We went to see, as a family, Live and Let Die, because we were curious to see how. We went to see Diamonds Are Forever when Sean Connery came back to it. And then 2 years later, we went to see Live and Let Die. And I felt a bit disappointed. I thought Roger Moore, very slick. And he should have stopped with Moonraker. He just got too old. I'm not being ageist. There's nothing wrong with a man in his 80s playing a sort of, you know. But A View to a Kill is one of my favourite Bond films, except for him. He's just too old, too mature for the part. They should have changed over. But I love that film. I love Grace Jones is in it. She's great. And then I kind of, to be honest, I faltered a bit. I did only watch them when they came on television, and I managed to get through. Timothy Dalton was the next one, and Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah.
Who was after Pierce Brosnan?
It went to Daniel Craig.
Oh, right. So I watched the first Daniel. The only Daniel Craig one I like is Skyfall. I do think Skyfall is a superb film. but I couldn't watch the others. They were just too visceral, too violent for my liking. And I thought, and too noisy, even on DVD, if I borrowed it from the library on DVD, the noise. I mean, obviously I'm getting older, but I did like Skyfall.
I'd perhaps urge you to rewatch Casino Royale, which is the Daniel Craig first one. I think there's a lot that's really queer about Casino Royale.
Is there?
Lot in it. You know, about identity and who we are and all that sort of stuff. But yeah,
That was his first one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was his first. Yeah,
I think I liked that one. I can't remember it very well, but I think I liked that one. And Skyfall, but the others I tried and just I gave up.
A lot of people listening to this will probably just be nodding along with you in lots of that and disagree. I mean, this is the fun of being a Bond fan. Everyone has opinions about the different actors and all.
But
that.
Sorry to interrupt you again, but it is a generational thing. You see, I loved Doctor Who in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I caught up on videotapes when they came out you could borrow them from video stores with the other doctors up until the last one in the 80s. And then it was rebooted and I loved the reboot. And then gradually, like with the Bond films, I thought, no, I can't handle this. Is it because I'm getting older? But I just thought anything with Steve Chibnall's name on it, I just wouldn't watch. I just thought awful, awful, awful. Too, like, in your face noise, you know, everyone running around screaming, blah, blah, blah. It actually lost the plot, and I'm dreading, and I don't think I watched any with Jodie Whittaker, and I'm kind of loving the fact they've put all the Doctor Who's on iPlayer, because I go back to my favorite ones. Sorry, I'm diverting from
no, I mean, I think Doctor Who
isn't it.
I've been thinking a lot about this recently, actually, in the comparisons of Doctor Who and Bond, you know, because they were both there kind of in the cultural zeitgeist in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
And
yeah, absolutely.
They've had resurgences. And I mean, I think I was born in 1982, so I'm not sure what Doctor that was at that point. But I remember seeing Sylvester McCoy on TV a little bit and then repeats with John Pertwee a lot on TV. But for me, my Doctor is the Russell T Davies era. So, so it's the Chris Eccleston, David Tennant.
Yeah, of course.
Less so the Matt Smith. But and then I've watched bits of the others, but I'm really excited about it coming back in that way. But you're right, we are sort of tied to the media we consumed at those earlier ages.
I feel very lucky to have come through the 60s as a very impressionable little gay boy who loved Doctor Who, loved the Bonds, loved Coronation Street. Can't stand them now. I can't watch Coronation Street now. I mean, I still think back to Ina Sharples and Elsie Tanner and even in 20 years ago, we still had Vera Duckworth and all these wonderful characters and decent writers and directors and actors. And now it's just drivel. It's not a generational thing, really. They're just gone downhill, in my humble opinion. I'm just so glad I can remember what it was like in the 60s and the 70s to watch all this stuff fresh and new, and I just embrace it. So which is why I spend more time than I should watching old DVDs of old programs.
Don't you think it's interesting though that a lot of these, you know, long-lasting British cultural products, icons, whatever you want to call them, have quite queer beginnings in terms of their creators.
Oh, absolutely.
Tony Warren, Coronation Street, you know, he wanted to write about the women he grew up surrounded with predominantly. Although I read the other day that very sadly he left after about 3 years because the writer's room became somewhat homophobic. But, you know, we've got him to credit for that. Doctor Who, you know, was directed, the first episode was directed by a gay British Indian guy.
I've met him.
Waris, yeah. And then you've got James Bond, who, although Ian Fleming wasn't queer, although his wife debated it occasionally, you know, he was surrounded by, in that kind of milieu, he was surrounded, and particularly some of the characters that you identify in Fighting Proud kind of intersect. Ian Fleming isn't in there, obviously, but quite a few people who he was quite close with are people like Noel Coward, obviously. Yeah. Cecil Beaton and Somerset Maugham appears. You know, he had at least a friendship with a young queer pilot. You've got Alan Turing, who Fleming must have met at some point. Yeah. Because he was so he was actually a lot closer in kind of the inner circle of naval intelligence than we realise. And he did go to Bletchley Park a lot. And actually, Alan Turing has appeared in at least one James Bond novel. So young James Bond met Alan Turing. And then you've got Winston Churchill, you know, who there is some kind of evidence that Winston Churchill might be queer. And he was a family friend of the Flemings. He wrote the biography of Fleming's dad when he was sadly killed in the First World War. And his editor was queer and worked with him in naval intelligence. So Fleming was in that milieu the whole time. And I think I partly think that the longevity of some of these things is because they had people wrote them with kind of different audiences in mind and different perspectives on the world, at least compared with things which going back to what you said right at the start, actually, where people have such a kind of narrow worldview. And I think some of those things have kind of gone, some of those cultural products have gone by the wayside. I don't know, but that's a hypothesis anyway.
But that's the joy of having these resources at our fingertips that we can revisit and reassess and analyze, or just sit back and enjoy. I mean, it's great. And I think there was a network of gay men, or men that enjoyed the company of gay men, at that time, without social media, without emails or texts or WhatsApp. It's interesting. So it is difficult to tease out who knew who and how well did Ian Fleming meet Alan Turing. Perhaps we'll never know, but it's interesting to pose that question and how these things all connected together and informed Ian Fleming's work, novels.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Licensed to Queer podcast. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Stephen. I certainly did. I think, as Stephen points out at the end, Bond raises a lot of really interesting questions. And I think the biggest takeaway for me from this conversation is to keep an open mind. While I've always kind of had that ambivalence towards the what we might term problematic characters of Bond, Stephen has reinforced my notion that we should not close down the fact that some of these characters have been very positive for some people. Yes, they reinforce some offensive stereotypes. Undoubtedly they do, but at the same time, and I've always argued this particularly with Winton Kidd, they are some of the only, well, they were the only representation that I really had as a kid. And I'm really grateful to Stephen for sharing his childhood memories of seeing a Bond film for the first time. How cool to have actually seen Goldfinger in the cinema back in 1964.